Hi, and welcome to Forest of the Future, the podcast series where we talk about innovation and trends and grand ideas in the world of sustainable forestry, climate mitigation, and of course, FSC. Today we are going to be talking about greenwashing, and we are going to be talking about that in the context of FSC. Why? Well, because we in FSC internally have been debating this exact topic for years when trying to strike the balance between communicating the importance of FSC, but without overpromising. That is a balance that can become challenging when you see other organizations with lesser ambition levels and safeguards communicating stronger messages. We're not the only ones struggling with this battle, which is why the EU and other regions are now looking into creating legislation that creates a level playing field. In the EU, the directive is called EU Green Claims, and it aims at ensuring that companies do not commit greenwashing about their products or operations. But what is the potential impact of such rules? And is that what we want? That is the topic of today, where I'm joined by Trevor Amell, the marketing director at FSC, and Anna Maria Baumann, who's the acting commercial director at FSC. And with that, why don't we just get started? Welcome, Trevor. This is the first time that you are on Forest for the Future. So can you start by setting the scene? What does the marketing unit inside an organization like FSC do beyond creating websites and social media assets, etc.?
Happy to set the scene. And can I just say, been a long time listener, Loa. So it is a thrill to be on this podcast today. So thank you so much for having me. And I'll just immediately tell you a little bit about the marketing team. In general, we're focused on telling FSC's diverse story to a diverse set of audiences. So reaching people, building engagement, growing the FSC brand, and creating awareness and understanding of the role that forests and FSC plays in creating a sustainable future.
Okay, so inspiring people, connecting them to our story. Anna Maria, let me pull you in then. Do you agree? Is this the most important thing that marketing does from your perspective of having a background in standards and legal frameworks, etc.? Is that where we should focus our marketing unit?
Thank you for the invite, Loa. It's a pleasure to be here. If Trevor's work is all about creativity, I would say that my work is where creativity meets credibility. I look at how the FSC logo is being used, what companies can say and cannot say about FSC certification, and how all of that aligns with the trust that consumers put in the FSC system. Mm. So if I think about my role in relation to the 60,000 plus companies that hold an FSC license, manufacturers, retailers, brands, forest managers, and so on, I want them to tell a great story about FSC, but I also want them to make sure that those stories are grounded in evidence and they uphold the trust that consumers put in the FSC system.
Mm. It sounds like you will be the perfect person to help me set the scene here. We've seen the term greenwashing evolve quite a lot over the last 10 years or so, at least while I've been working with FSC. So can you help describe what is the current definition of greenwashing and what is it not?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. You know, I started working in this field for almost a decade. And when I started, greenwashing and the term was more like a niche term. And now it's central to how we talk about sustainability and environmental practices and so on. If I was to put it really simple, greenwashing is about misrepresentation. So it's when a company makes environmental claim, and that environmental claim is for some reason misleading, exaggerated, or just not backed by real evidence. If you are a visual person like me, you can think of it like the gap between what's being said and what's actually been done. So if you think of how greenwashing shows up, it's in all kinds of ways. It could be from very simple things like a company using green colors or blue colors if you are into oceans, or nature-related images or buzzwords to look sustainable, even if there is no substance behind it. Or it could be a bit more sophisticated, like when companies highlight one small positive impact or aspect of a product to distract from much bigger environmental impacts. We call that hidden trade-off tactic in greenwashing. But regardless of the tactic, whether it's more simple or more sophisticated, the outcome of greenwashing is the same, namely that customers are misled and that erodes trust for everyone.
Actually, would you agree that over the last years or so, some of the first cases of greenwashing we saw, they were really obvious. It was really like, okay, here's a car that has green leaves moving out of the exhaustion pipe because it's just so green. And then you could see on the tax that it was like 3% of whatever content was in that fuel was actually from some sort of bio source. So it was sort of obvious that, okay, they're really trying to paint something that's greener than it is. Until now, I think you really sometimes have to be an expert as a consumer to really find the granularity in when something is greenwashing and when it is not. Would you agree that that's a shift that we've seen?
Yeah, that's a very good observation, Loaya. I fully agree. I sometimes feel like we are putting consumers in the shoes of an expert all the time when they navigate shelf. And I would say, yeah, the greenwashing has become a lot more sophisticated over the years, especially when companies start talking about their values, their environmental goals, their sustainability overall. Then these misleading claims can easily be hidden in the context.
And I would just add that the consistent greenwashing examples have really received a lot of press in themselves, which kind of contributes to an erosion of consumer trust and increasing skepticism. And I think we're not getting into the other kinds and flavors of greenwashing, you know, like green hushing, green lighting, and others, but actually the fear of being accused of greenwashing in itself is an obstacle that prevents companies from feeling the confidence to really actively communicate their often legitimate contributions to the topic.
But now you named them. So now we have to sort of define them for audience, because now they're sitting in the room between us and will be part of a conversation. So can we just really briefly, green hushing, what is that, Trevor?
Green hushing is when, even if a company has a committed and verifiable ESG strategy or sustainability strategy, they refuse to publicize any information around their sustainability commitments or how they're achieving those commitments. So, you know, it's just kind of hiding the good things that they're doing. And it's typically out of fear for the high bar and high burden of verification that sometimes is required in the public communication space. And it just, some companies view it as an easier path to kind of diminish some of their positive contributions.
And green lighting?
Green lighting is a greenwashing tactic when businesses use selective disclosure or symbolic actions, exactly as Anna Maria mentioned, to draw attention away from their overall environmental impact. So it kind of muddies the picture a little bit.
Okay. So it's putting the spotlight where they want. So we will focus on the rest. Okay. Trevor, I know that being the creative person you are, you have created sort of a quiz for Anna Maria on examples of greenwashing.
I have. Of course, we like to bring the fun and the inspiration into this a little bit. So, but the reason is because this is such an important topic, and greenwashing can be, to many, this umbrella term where it can mean a lot of different things to different people. So I think it's really helpful that we've started with this definition from Anna Maria's academic perspective, but let's see if we can make it more tangible with some examples. Mm-hmm. So we've got a bit of a game show. I have high expectations for your production studio, Loa, for the sound effects. But instead of the Great British Bake Off, we're going to have the Great Greenwashing Guess Off, where I will share a few examples and then Anna Maria will assess, is it greenwashing? Is it not greenwashing? We'll see where we get to. We've prepared a few examples. How does that sound, Loa?
Sounds fantastic. So let's go.
Okay. Example one, Anna Maria. You're in a supermarket. You see a bottle. You're a consumer, by the way. You're in a supermarket. You pick up a bottle. It clearly says eco-friendly, big, bold letters. You look around. You can't see much of an explanation. No obvious. What do you think? Is this greenwashing?
I would say it's definitely a red flag. If you don't have any substance behind the claim, no transparency, yeah, that's potentially greenwashing. A good claim should be substantiated by easily accessible information. So the consumer in the shop should be able to easily tell what makes the bottle eco-friendly.
Okay, thank you for that. And I think this also gets to the point that we were mentioning earlier in terms of the expectations on the consumer as an expert in this case to assess at the moment of purchase whether or not something is greenwashing. But we'll come back to that, I think, later. Let's move on. Second example. A company, we won't name names, invents their own green badge. It looks a lot like a certification scheme or third-party verification. It's a green leaf in a circle, but it's more just a marketing design. It's not apparent if there's a system or a third-party verification that sits behind the company's green badge. So what do you think about this, Anna Maria?
If it looks official, but there is no recognized tender behind it, that's a credibility gap, I would say, because real labels are backed up by a system that is transparent and robust, like FSC is. But I would say here, from an expert perspective, this is one of the tactics that we dislike the most, because this undermines trust in real certification scheme. And you might have read that in 2020, the European Commission did a study where they assessed over 200 active ecolabels in the EU. And they concluded that for half of them, the verification was either weak or there was no verification at all. And some of those labels that the EU assessed were just this certification-like images, like in your example, which were misleading consumers into thinking that a certain product has been through a legitimate certification process.
Now, Loa is dying to get in on that regulatory point, but we're going to come to it later. So just for the purposes of this game show, I'm going to keep it moving, but then I know we're going to come back to that point a little bit more, Anna Maria, shortly. So you're still in the supermarket. This time you've moved to the, office supplies section part of the supermarket, and you pick up a notebook. It appears to be made of certified paper. Let's say it's FSC certified paper, of course, but there's no other sustainability features mentioned. So the packaging says the notebook is FSC certified, hence it's environmentally friendly. What do you think about that? I mean, FSC appears to be all over this notebook, so it seems like it would be a good case, right? What do you think?
Yeah, that's where we run into nuances, I would say. So let me start with this. Using FSC certified paper is definitely a good thing, and companies that label the notebook and they went through the certification, they should definitely talk about it in the store. But calling the entire notebook environmentally friendly just based on this one attribute, that could potentially be a stretch, I would say, because it implies that the whole product, the ink, the binding, the production process, the transport maybe, is good for the environment, which we don't know. So even if the intent is positive, the claim ends up being too broad and potentially misleading in the absence of relevant evidence. So potentially greenwashing.
And then you're mentioning the environmentally friendly point is kind of problematic in that communication, and that it could be seen to take credit for the entire life cycle of the production of the notebook. Of course, in this example, we've picked something that is almost exclusively linked to forest-based materials, but you can see if we picked another example where the forest-based material footprint is less, that it could be even more complex to sort of deduce what's meant by that.
Yeah. Had it been a couch where it's only like the interior wooden frame that's actually FSC certified. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, greenwashing doesn't always mean that the company is being intentionally deceptive. Sometimes the intention is good, but the communication is vague or is missing important context. And then the result is the same, that consumers are misled, even if that wasn't on purpose.
And final example, this is a supermarket with all kinds of products. So now we're moving into furniture. So it's quite a mega big box type supermarket here that we've got here. But on the chair, the company, I guess the manufacturer of this chair, says the wood of this chair comes entirely from FSC certified forests. They also provide information around what FSC means, why it matters, and provide a link for further information. What about that? Sounds good to me, but what about to you, Anna Maria, the greenwashing expert in our game here?
That's what we love to see. So it's specific, it's backed by a credible third-party certification, doesn't overstate things. It tells the consumer what part of the product is certified, right? The wood, why it matters, provides a link to further information. Yeah, great.
Okay, so we've ended with one that is not greenwashing, but is actually more a best practice of what we would like to encourage listeners of this podcast to pay attention to. How did we do, Loa? How was that as an observer?
Well, you did good. It was good. Yeah, you could be a co-host, Trevor, in the future of the podcast. So I guess what we can conclude is be specific and attach it to the actual product. I'd love to transition us a bit into the world of FSC. And Trevor, for those who knows us, and I guess everybody listening can hear that we have a dynamic. And that dynamic really often has started in a very deep conversation about what can we actually claim about FSC and what can we not. We've had our bumps in the past about what can we actually possibly say about FSC. So can you take us through the golden rules of what can you claim about FSC and what is a no-go when it comes to communicating about FSC?
The problem areas are messaging points that are not accurate, not verifiable. Relevance is in question. You know, I think some of these examples, we saw the tendency to want to overstate the role of FSC. FSC is, of course, a very reputable mark, and there is a tendency to want to apply that reputation as far as possible, but it has to be in line with the scope and the contribution and sort of the details on the ground. So I think that tension is really the area that we spend the majority of our time sort of investigating and also ensuring that the communications that sit behind FSC certified products are clear. And this, of course, is a perfect segue into Anna Marie, who may want to add a bit more to this topic as well, knowing that it's a live one on our side.
Yeah, Anna Marie, because you're right now our acting commercial director, but you have been working with trademark and the rules of our trademarks for many years. So, Gefs, you have seen all there is to see in terms of examples of what can we claim about FSC. When does it become more difficult to create these clear-cut rules? Like, where are the areas where it's really difficult to define what can we say and what can't we say and who can we work with, who can't we work with, etc.?
Yeah, that's a great question and quite front of mind for me as we are currently revising our trademark standard. So this is the standard that contains the rules for the use of the FSC marks. And there are indeed, like you say, areas where things start to get a bit more complex and honestly also a bit more interesting for me and my team. So I can tell you where things are very easy and then where things get a bit more complicated. So we can generally create very clear rules around on-product labeling. So you can say, you can use the FSC label here with this text if all the forest-based materials of the product are certified. So that's fairly black and white. Where it starts getting a bit more interesting is in off-product communications, especially, like I said before, when companies start talking about their values, their goals, their sustainability journey more broadly, where FSC is only part of the puzzle. And this is where claims get more aspirational, more value-based, and also more open to interpretation. I can give an example if you want. So let's say a company uses FSC-certified materials in one product line, but they create a video that says, we care deeply about our FSC-certified forest. And in this video, they show several of their products. They also bring a forester that talks about how they manage their forest in their family for generations. So they bring in these emotions and values and connection, right, to the forest. Is that claim, we care deeply about FSC-certified forest, credible? Remember, the company only uses FSC-certified materials in one product line. And they may be positioning the video in a way that implies that all their products are certified, right? Which would be misleading. So context matters, and the regulating context in a document, which we also want to keep simple and short and user-friendly, is not always easy.
Mm-hmm. What is the most difficult part at the moment in navigating this jungle?
I would say two things. On the one hand, companies' expectations are sky high and everyone wants to be seen as green. And on the other hand, sustainability is nuanced and FSC covers one part of the puzzle, but companies want simple and quick messages. And that's where the risk comes in of oversimplifying. And then there is also this gap between intention and execution. Most companies, I think, based on my experience, want to do the right thing, but they also want to tell a compelling story. And then in trying to inspire and sound good, it's easy to oversimplify or overstate, right? So we as FSC and my team have a responsibility to help clients walk this path between not underplaying the value that FSC brings, but also not stretching the claim beyond what FSC certification actually covers.
Mm-hmm. And I think this has been a journey too, right, Trevor? If I think back, at least I started in FSC almost 20 years ago with communications. In everything that we did in those early years, we would say, if you're FSC, everything is A-OK. So would you say that it's been a journey as well, both internally and externally, to have this more holistic mindset that we actually don't cover it all, we only cover parts of it? Are you seeing that internally in everything that we do as well?
I think over the past 20 years, FSC, as it becomes more relevant with more industries, more sectors, more actors, it has inherently become a bit more complex in terms of additional, you know, the mixed label is a great sort of example that sometimes complicates the nice and inspiring messages that we might want to put out to the public in an external sense. Our own product evolution in terms of our increasing relevance and our desire to sort of deliver the mission and a variety of products and services even beyond certification. When it comes to messaging what we actually do, this can make it a bit more challenging to be very understandable to a consumer, for example, given kind of our hands are in many different pots and how to sort of pull that together. I think also the design of our standards, in a sense of we have the principles and criteria, which are like the 10 commandments that are sort of universal, while also allowing that local adaptation, is also a challenge too in terms of how you make statements that are not true everywhere, but are generally true in a lot of places. So I think making confident global statements that are always true in every part of the world that we operate in is certainly a challenge. We also see the intersection of regulation and what we're saying, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of this too. But as it relates to deforestation, you know, FSC has always had a role in helping companies prevent deforestation. That's especially true in the FSC certified forests of the world. But of course, this is now law in the European Union, at least, and could be in other parts of the world as well, which we encourage. So in this sense, it's something that's become regulated. There's also the desire from companies to communicate their specific impact, which the methodology and the data required to isolate that in a credible way and to scale that up is very challenging. But it's an area that we're moving into with verified impact, for example, which should allow us to make specific and credible claims around carbon sequestration or biodiversity.
So it sounds like there's also been a shift in being more accurate internally and externally, actually, over the last few years.
It's a good follow-up because internally, we are sometimes our own biggest critics, which is a positive, I say, because once everything has been internally vetted, we have people that think through really in an excruciating amount of detail, which sometimes can be frustrating for the project manager. But in the end, we have really kicked the tires and come up with every possible thing that could be, every possible interpretation has been considered. So I think our internal awareness of greenwashing, our internal awareness of the what's at stake in terms of our own reputation is extremely high. So what that means is we have a global community of watchdogs who are always keeping an eye on our own messaging, which I think ultimately makes it all the better, all the stronger as well.
I admit to being one of those watchdogs, and I'm sorry.
I knew you would.
I'm sorry. But one of the more recent conversations that we've actually had is exactly on this, the safeguarding of our own brand when we enter into collaborations with companies. So we're, of course, really fortunate that a lot of the biggest brands in the world really want to collaborate with us and enter into partnerships. Of course, because our brand has something to offer in terms of value to them. But every time we do so, these collaborations also come with a risk to us. Do you ever fear that a brand solely want to partner with us because they want to use our logo? And how do we evaluate the substance behind their efforts and whether it's enough before we enter into a collaboration with a potential brand on one of these global collaborations?
Yeah, I've heard that concern a lot, but I happen to not agree with it. And the reason is because, as you mentioned, there are 60,000 companies that have gone through a rigorous assessment process in order to be associated with FSC to begin with. So marketing, we have this luxury of looking across this impressive system of committed and forest advocates who, you know, have made commitments which are demonstrated through FSC. So if anything, we're kind of choosing from a bit of a pre-vetted list of credible companies that have already gone through independent third-party verification, have already decided to conform with rigorous and robust standards. So in this sense, it's a little bit easier in the sense of we already have this verification built into the system. So from a marketing perspective, we then look at companies that are furthering our objectives in niche value chains. I can think of rubber as a good example, or some of these areas where we're not quite as prolific as we might be when it comes to the notebook that Anna Maria very easily earlier on saw FSC all over. There are plenty of value chains where our footprint is not as large as it could be. So in those senses, there are kind of these first movers and leaders who are really helping to sort of pave the way for that particular industry. And those are natural candidates for us to consider joint promotions and co-marketing and partner marketing with. Of course, we want to assess if it makes sense for us strategically as an organization. But in general, we're fishing from a very credible pond, which I think is a luxury that many other marketers and peers don't have as easily as we do.
So what is the process? If a company wants to partner with us, do we evaluate them before we allow it? Or do we say, well, it's fine, you're certified, you're good?
Partnering with FSC, I mean, we make it easy for them to communicate their own association. So the recent launch of the FSC Brand Hub, which provides, of course, the label generator and the means to communicate through ready-made assets, their association with FSC and providing the guidance around messaging. As we've mentioned in this podcast, there is some nuance that can sometimes be difficult to capture. So providing those more than 60,000 companies with the ability to communicate their association with FSC and thereby what that means for forests in a really credible way is kind of the most important sort of starting point that we can evaluate. We also have global campaigns like FSC Forest Week, where any of these certificate holders or promotional license holders can participate in this global moment for forests where everyone communicates in a harmonized way their commitments and how FSC is a part of driving forward their objectives. And then in terms of which companies we may put on the website, for example, this is where it depends on the robustness and power of their commitment. So it tends to be companies with 100% commitment in certain developing supply chains. It tends to be companies who have a pioneering or leadership role to play. They might be the first, which we hope will be the first of many. Yeah, so those are some of the considerations that we talk through. I think we would like to make partner marketing in the future more systematic, and this coincides with some of our development plans for 2025 is exactly this point around kind of making the assessment criteria more known within FSC in this sense. But for now, I think my key message is that FSC is already a very credible system. So I think we have a lot that we're able to build on top of rather than creating from scratch.
The watchdog has a follow-up question or a tangible example that I'd like to grill you a bit about, because we've been partnering with some big companies. We've been partnering in motorsports. We've been partnering in massive global retail. One of my questions is that these companies that we're choosing to partner with, yes, they're big brands, but they're also brands that has a major carbon footprint. And we could question whether or not they're actually helping to save our planet, or whether they're actually helping to solve the planetary crises when what they're doing is motorsports and fast-moving consumer goods. So can you provide a bit of a rationale as to why should we, from your perspective, partner with these types of companies too?
Sure. Maybe we can take motorsports as one example. So massive audiences, many are not the typical sustainability crowd that we have opportunities to talk to often. So in this case, it's an opportunity to connect with those who are interested in how they may be able to support in kind of an unexpected way. So I think that on the surface, FSC being somehow associated with motorsports races might be a surprise to some. But in this case, it's not FSC having a relationship with the racetrack, for example, but rather the certificate holder who does have skin in the game in terms of natural rubber supply, which is an important topic to us at FSC in terms of the smallholder connection, in terms of the fact that natural rubber, 85% of the supply comes from tire manufacturers. And what better way to showcase the importance and the possibility of responsible natural rubber than through really mainstream high awareness moments? You know, it's important to note that it wasn't just a marketing activation at one race with nothing else to follow. This particular certificate holder, which is Pirelli, is a leader in responsible natural rubber. And it was really, for them, part of a larger strategy that saw major milestones, not only in tires, which I mentioned are very important in terms of the supply, but also bicycle tires. And they've had many commitments that have really shown the race was actually the start, not the end, not the finish in this case. And all of this really helps accelerate the transition to more responsible natural rubber and ultimately improve the livelihoods of the thousands of rubber farmers in Southeast Asia that really need it and are often overlooked. So in this case, why wouldn't we want to further promote a success story within our certification system, especially when the results are multifaceted, there's impact that's demonstrated that can be traced all the way back to the forest. So this is a perfect example of one that I think is something that we should be more confident in sharing, also as a moment of inspiration to show, you know, nobody thought that FSC being in race cars was even possible, but I think it stretches the limits of the perceptions of what a certification system even is and what it can do.
But don't we also, by doing so, endorse a very high carbon sports?
We're specific around the rubber. Natural rubber is what we're talking about in relation to that. So I think, as Anna Maria mentioned earlier, the nuance is important in this case. And in this sense, that it's also important. And we should highlight that our relevance is not, we're not the ones working on the shipping and the logistics of the race cars around the world. We're the ones that are helping verify that the natural rubber provided in tires meets really high environmental and social standards. So I think the framing is what is important. And with this example, I don't know, Lo, if you typically post little links in your show notes, but I'm happy to give you some more information about this particular example that listeners who may be interested in reading more about.
Mm-hmm. Anna Maria, I'd like to pull you back in, because this whole debate that Trevor and I just had, won't that become a bit trigger with this new piece of EU legislation called EU Green Claims? When that enters the door, it's under development right now. Can you explain a bit more about what that is and how it sort of connects to what Trevor and I just talked about?
Sure. Thanks for the question. As you mentioned, the Green Claims Directive is not a law yet. It's still under development. So what we are discussing here is just based on the draft that we have seen over the past 2 years from the Commission and the Council and the Parliament, and the direction that we are seeing. But what it is, it's a proposed legislation in the EU which aims to combat greenwashing. I can tell you about some of the important components of this proposed legislation. The first one is that the proposed legislation introduces minimum criteria for environmental labeling schemes to comply with, to ensure that these schemes are solid and transparent and reliable. So this would be criteria that also FSC would have to comply with and then undergo an approval by a relevant authority at the member state level. And then the European Commission will publish and maintain a list of officially recognized environmental labels that are allowed to be used in the EU market. So this is one component of the legislation. The second one, and probably the most useful from expert perspective, is a piece around substantiation of and communication of claims. So the proposed legislation introduces requirements on how to prove your claims as a company that sells in the EU. And then the third component is around the fact that claims would need to be checked by a verifier, independent accredited verifier, before they go into the market. These are the main components of the legislation, but What is maybe important to say before this becomes a law and we've seen the final text is what is the idea behind this legislation? And that has to do with the fact that when companies in Europe make these bold environmental claims or promises without evidence to back them up, consumers, like the consumers that Trevor mentioned in the supermarkets, are left in the dark and they don't know whether a certain claim is greenwashing or it's real. And then with that, they're not able to make purchasing decisions that would have a real positive environmental impact. So with these rules, the EU tries to require businesses to prove their claims through proper data, the proper checks before putting them on the market, so that you as a consumer can make informed decisions, and then those decisions would have a real environmental impact. And that's the reason why the three of us come to work every day, right?
Yeah, and you're right. Then we also have the EMCO, or the Empowering Consumers Directive. What is that? And how does it connect to the green claims?
Yeah, they're connected and they are complementing each other. So empowering consumers, the way I look at it, is this broad consumer protection framework. So it sets requirements to prevent unfair commercial practices in the EU. So it basically says you as a company in the EU cannot mislead consumers in Europe with unfair commercial practices, including misleading claims, but not only. It's a horizontal legislation. And then the green claims says here is how you can substantiate and how you can communicate and how you can verify those claims so that you don't mislead consumers in Europe, right? So they are connected. Just to give a better idea about empowering consumers, it prohibits these generic claims like green or eco-friendly or carbon neutral that are not substantiated. So in the example that Trevor provided with the bottle label as eco-friendly, with no explanation, no link, no evidence, that would be prohibited on the EU market as of 1996. Then it also prohibits making claims about an entire product when it concerns only a certain aspect of the product. So it requires companies to be very specific about what part of the product the claim refers to.
Okay, so the notebook also wouldn't be okay under the EMCO.
The notebook would also not be okay unless you are specifying exactly what part of the product is certified in this case, or the claim, what part of the product or the claim refers to.
And it sounds like the Green Claims Directive might address the second example where you had this generic label invented by a company with no real standards or verification behind it.
Yeah, correct. So it also cracks down on sustainability labels which are not backed by a certification scheme. So this self-made label that looks like a certification, this green leaf in a circle that is not backed by a system, but just a marketing design, that would not be allowed on the EU market.
So if we just imagine a dream world now where all of this legislation, both pieces of it, were entered into force, what would the impact be on the conversation that Trevor and I just had? Would there have, through the legislation, been set rules in stone so there wasn't a role for me as an internal watchdog anymore, because there's just things that we have to follow about who can we partner with, what can we claim, etc., as an organization, and them with us, vice versa?
Yeah, so that's an important question, and one that I'm very happy you ask, because I would have the opportunity to tell you something that I'm very excited about when it comes to this legislation. So what's really promising about this legislation is that it creates a type of a shared foundation of, or a shared language. And let me tell you why. So at the moment, when certification schemes talk to brands, or even when brands talk to several schemes, because some of the brands work with several certification schemes, there is a lot of room for interpretation when it comes to certain terms or concepts. So I can give you an example. What constitutes, for example, enough evidence when it comes to an environmental claim, right? This can shift depending on who you're talking to. And this is both for labeling schemes, but also for brands. And then with these new laws, if they come into effect, which we really hope so, we are moving towards a common language where schemes and brands and consumers are all working from the same set of expectations. And this clarity helps everyone, I think. For brands, it will provide this clear structure to build the sustainability strategies around, especially when they work with several schemes. And then for consumers, it will provide that confidence that when you are in that supermarket and you choose a product that has an environmental claim, you will know that that claim is backed up by evidence and that your purchase had a positive, a real positive impact on the environment. So in that way, the legislation is important because it enforces some rules, but it also facilitates better conversations based on a common language, based on a shared foundation. And that's why I'm excited about that as a sustainability professional.
What about the impact on FSE? If, again, a dream world, the legislation is now in place, would our license holders be in compliance if they just, I'm saying just like in quotation marks, follow our standards? Would they then be home free in connection to these legislations?
I would say that our license holders are very well positioned for what the EU Green Claims legislation is aiming to achieve. And I'm saying that because our license holders are part of a system that is built on independent verification, clear rules around the claims, approval process before anything goes on the market, strict rules for the use of the mark. So in that sense, they are already ahead of the curve. And I think also importantly, our license holders have the right mindset, which is also important in a company, and basic processes and procedures in place around credible claims.
Trevor, I'm wondering, because this legislation on the table, it's EU-based and follows therefore the EU regions and the companies in the EU regions. Are we seeing similar tendencies of firming up rules in other parts of the world, or are we seeing other mechanisms than just legislation pushing in this direction of being more accurate and proof-driven in your communications?
Yeah, I think I would answer that first by highlighting that this is a global world that we live in. So a lot of these companies that are affected within the European Union are also operating globally. Therefore, the EUDR, for example, the deforestation regulation, one could say it's a global regulation rather than a European one. However, I think this really speaks to the strength of the European Union as a regulatory leader and regulatory powerhouse in a way. Just to take another legislation completely outside of this space, but a bit of a predecessor, is GDPR, the Global Data Privacy Regulation, which has resulted in all of these annoying cookie banners that we see all the time. And I constantly just say, I agree, or necessary only, I think is actually what I've learned to now select instead. But that was just something that arose from the European Union. But now, rather than companies having to follow multiple systems and track how the infrastructure required and the investment required, is become a lot easier to just follow one way for the world. And we've seen mirror legislations with, you know, the California Privacy Act and things like this as well. We are admittedly a bit on the early stages of this European Green Deal and all of the legislations that are coming from it in terms of seeing exact replicas sort of form within other markets. However, it's where we see the signs of everything moving. And it's partially why we've been very keen on investing and making sure that EUDR, for example, can be done properly, as we do anticipate other countries in the future to follow suit with similar legislations. But we're at an earlier sort of point in that journey, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about these other types of mechanisms? I'm thinking net zero, science-based targets for nature, etc. Are you seeing any impact of those?
I can take this. So there are obviously mechanisms outside the law that are shaping how companies can make environmental claims and how we can empower consumers to make those good choices that have a positive impact on the environment. So I can think of industries that are self-regulating. So for example, in the UK, you have the Advertising Standards Authority, ASA, that is working with sectors like fashion and food to enforce green marketing codes, even though ASA is not a government agency. Then you can also think of voluntary standards like FSE that aren't mandated by law, but they do give consumers trust and they give consumers the tool to identify better products. And there are also some advertising standard bodies in some countries, regulators that issue guidance or take down misleading green ads, even without formal legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking also that this whole fact that companies are committing to net zero, they're committing to science-based target for nature in particular, and that all of this puts them in this mindset of having to measure and having to verify and having to update every single year. And that then trickles through the organization in terms of, okay, well, we actually have to be able to prove what we're saying that we're doing, we're actually also doing.
Yeah, and there is also this investor and kind of market pressure, right? So this ESG reporting, the stakeholder demand, and these sustainable finance initiatives that are pushing companies to clean up their claims because greenwashing is seen also as a reputational and a financial risk.
Mm-hmm. So, Trevor, as an organization who are working with this legislation, what are we doing to prepare ourselves for it to enter into effect?
Yeah, so it's been very front of mind for us in a couple of complementary processes that we're going through at the moment. First and foremost is for license holders, giving them the confidence and clarity about the current state of their compliance has been a goal in some of the trademark standard updates, for example, that Anna Maria referred to. But we also have to go through this exercise for ourselves as well. And some of the legislation, while we have sort of early drafts, it's not yet final. So we're in a state, green claims, of monitoring and actively engaging with EU decision makers who are working on this particular legislation. And here we want to raise the bar of environmental claims and ensure that the provisions will actually work when implemented in a system like FSC. So here our role is more on the advocacy front and working with partners like ICEAL Alliance, for example, and some of the other certification schemes like FSC, who represent different commodities that may be covered, and ensuring what gets put into the legislation can be implemented. So that's a little bit of the work that we're doing right now on the green claims front. And then for empowering consumers, we're looking through, analyzing legislation, and we're actively adopting or adapting our trademark use rules to align with those expectations. And here, I think this is part of what the claims and labeling team, our trademark team within FSC, has been really leading on. So I don't know, Anna Maria, if you wanted to add anything to that.
Well, I can ask you a follow-up, Anna Maria, because does that mean that license holders can actually count on us in supporting them in really clear guidance on what can they say and what can they not say about FSC, and that we will be supporting them perhaps even more than we have in the past in not committing greenwashing?
Yeah, thanks for the question and for the opportunity to tell our license holders that yes, they can absolutely count on us. We want our license holders to continue to feel confident in the claims they make with FSC, and we are going to support them once the EU Green Claims is adopted, and not only with rules, but also, like you said, with clarity and resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Trevor, what about us internally? Do you think that this will change the way that we select who we work with or select how we communicate about ourselves and our impact? Do you think these legislations will impact the way that we're working internally?
I think it will create a harmonized agreement on definitions that we would all benefit from. Therefore, it should be a more clear environment to operate within. I also think in terms of the wider marketplace, let's say that these legislations are very favorable to FSC in a sense of it's kind of weeding out a lot of the bad actors, and it makes the role and the value of FSC a lot more clear in terms of being the kind of on-the-ground implementer to support companies and communicating credibly with FSC. Internally as FSC, like I mentioned, we're going through the similar and exact same processes that license holders will have to go through themselves. For now, the focus is a little bit more on the external component of it. And certainly once this legislation becomes law in full, I think we'll have a better informed understanding of what that means for us internally as well. But it's part of why we've aligned our messaging review processes to coincide with these updates, so that as soon as we know what we need to follow, that's something that we can immediately incorporate into our own communications.
Mm-hmm. So, we're rounding up towards the end of the podcast. I have one more question for the both of you. If legislation and this legislation coming up, if the tendency is that there are more rules on what can be claimed about what is sustainable and not sustainable, if all of this firms up, what do you hope and think the effect is in the short and medium term? Do you think that this will be a potential driver for FSC, or the other side of the coin, will FSC become irrelevant because everything is just at an equal pair and therefore we don't need to go beyond legislation?
I can start. I think it's a good question and also one that comes up a lot in conversation we are having with partners and with teams internally. I think in the short term, we are going to be seeing a bit of a shakeup, probably a period of adjustment, maybe hopefully a cleanup in the market. And then medium term, I would think the legislation will raise the bar for environmental communication overall, in terms of having less vague claims, more specificity, more evidence-based claims, less storytelling and more story doing, if you will. And I think for FSC, it's an opportunity because when everyone is asked to prove their claims, I think credible certifications like ours become more valuable. And then from a personal perspective, I would say that it's also an exciting time to be in as a sustainability communication expert. I think this, if implemented well, this piece of legislation is a win for credibility, for trust, for less skepticism in the sustainability space, better purchasing decisions by consumers, and I think most importantly, for real positive impact on the environment driven by these more credible claims.
Mm-hmm. Trevor?
Yeah, I think the opportunities for FSC to play this guidance role in supporting companies, I think it will, in the medium term in particular, have a real impact in terms of the value of FSC. I hope, as a side effect of this, license holders will develop an appreciation for the robustness of the FSC system. So in other words, kind of the complexity that sometimes we hear about, there's a real positive to it as it comes to complying with bureaucracy from the European Union, for example. So I hope that this whole discussion, we can look back at this podcast and sort of point to as like, this was a moment in which FSC's role really evolved in this sense. And personally, I hope that, you know, there's been a lot of fear out in the market of communicating credibly just because the bar is so high and there's been so much skepticism and criticism of greenwashing, and the fear has really, I think, taken a toll in terms of inspiring stories that really keep everyone moving. I think through this legislation and some of these initiatives that we've talked about today, we should be moving out of that kind of collective fear and more to a point of communicating from a sense of confidence now that it's all aligned. So I guess that's a bit of a lofty ambition, but I hope we can get to a point where there's more collective understanding in terms of how impact should be communicated in a credible way. And as a result, we can see more impact in the world.
And hopefully get a bit away from all of the green hushing.
Exactly. Green shouting, I think, should be what we strive for. I just coined that so we can work on the trademark, Anna Maria, afterwards.
I would love to get to a green shouting face and actually make a shift in this world. Thank you both for participating and for humoring all of my questions and crazy follow-ups.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a real delight. We will also mention that we're working on a bit of a microsite as well on the topic of greenwashing, where we can publish updates around some of these legislations that we've mentioned today, knowing that some of it is evolving. So as soon as we know more, we'll have a place where license holders in the audience can come to see more tangible results maybe than we previewed with you today. So we'll be sure to share that separately through the show notes.
That concludes my conversation with Trevor and Anna Maria on claims about FSC, the EU Green Deal, and the EMCO. I have to admit that I'm happy to see that we're finally getting to rules about greenwashing and that they are fairly tight. Let's hope that Anna Maria is right when she's hoping that this will lead to a cleanup of greenwashing and overclaiming, and that it will make it easier for companies to identify what they can say and what they cannot say. But I also really hope that Trevor's dream come true when he hopes that this leads to green shouting and that companies will use this as a global driver to communicate proudly about all of the work that they're doing to make this world a better place. Because we will need those inspiring stories and good news if we are to combat the planetary crises successfully, which we of course must. Remember to subscribe to Forest of the Future if you want to get notified of new episodes where we dive into other innovations within FSC and the world of certification and sustainable forest management.
You can also always get in touch with me on podcast@fsc.org. I am Loa Dalgard-Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.